Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, welcome to the New Books Network's Library Science Channel. My name is Hillel Yadin, and I am here with Dr. David Mack Marquis, one of the editors of Books Through Bars, Stories from the Prison Books Movement. Thank you for joining us today, and would you mind telling us a little bit about yourself and the book?
Sure, absolutely. Thanks for asking. Hello. I'm indeed Dr. Dave Mack Marquis, but most folks do just call me Mac. I'm currently a historian by trade, but I've worn many hats in my life. Pertinent to this book and interview, I've been an activist in various social movements for several decades. I would also like to take a second and thank both you and the New Books Networks for having me on to discuss Books Through Bars, Stories from Prison Books Movement. I want to also say that this book would not be possible without my co-editor, Moira, and all of the people who contributed chapters, but also to all the people who volunteered for Prison Books over the years. I guess the easiest way to get into this is to give a general framing of the book and then explain what Prison Books is, and then perhaps we can move on to talk about the book specifically.
Yeah, sounds great.
Okay. So this is a book about a social movement that in many ways has flown under the radar for well over 50 years. The Prison Books Movement is comprised of a disparate group of people who send free books to incarcerated people. And over the last several decades, this movement has sent tens of thousands of free books inside, answered tens of thousands of letters from people inside asking for books. And to the best of my knowledge, there's been no work that has attempted to document this movement and to introduce this movement as a whole to the general public. So really, this book kind of, you know, we're striving to tell the story of this movement and to kind of share this story with the general public and academics as well. One of the reasons this movement has flown under the radar is likely because of the population that we serve. That population is designed to remain invisible and forgotten to the general public. Of course, I'm talking about incarcerated people. The people in this movement refuse to not see and refuse to forget our fellow citizens. And this is particularly important because the United States has the highest rate of incarceration per capita in the world. In other words, we imprison our citizens at a higher rate than any other country. According to the Prison Policy Institute, there's over 1.9 million incarcerated people currently in the United States. Black and brown citizens are disproportionately incarcerated, and it's also worth noting that roughly 750,000 incarcerated people have not yet been convicted of any crime and are incarcerated because they cannot afford bail. So in order to really get a handle on the book, we have to take a second and explain what Prison Books is and what these organizations do. As the interview with Lorenzo Comba Irvin notes, several decades ago, the only book allowed inside the majority of prisons in the United States was the Bible. And that changed through the legal work of an incarcerated man named Martin Sostra. Sostra's lawsuits were successful, and others, like Lorenzo Comba Irvin, followed the framework he provided and pushed for access to books throughout state, local, and federal prisons. And over time, people on the outside organized to send books through the bars to incarcerated people, and thus was born the Prison Books Movement. So I guess I'll take a second and explain kind of what a typical Prison Books program does. Okay. And we can circle back around to the movement as a whole, if you like. Most Prison Books programs are volunteer-run and staffed. We get books donated to us, or we fundraise to purchase what we need. Typically, we'll find a space that is free or cheap, or we can house books and package them to send inside. This space may be in someone's basement. It may be in the back of a bookstore. It really varies and depends upon each individual program. We get letters from incarcerated people asking for books. Hands down, the most commonly requested book is a dictionary. And many people are surprised by that. And I think that the surprise results from a lack of understanding that many people on the inside are indeed looking for ways to make their lives better. And that's no easy task while incarcerated. There are other most commonly requested genres of books, such as urban fiction, westerns, African-American history, thrillers. I mean, it really runs the gamut what people request. Word games, crossword word games like Sudoku, crossword puzzles are also commonly requested. And we do our best to fill those requests, but we don't always have the exact books that someone wants. But that's kind of the baseline for most programs. But there are other materials that many of us stock and send inside, things such as the National Prisoners Resource List or NPRL. The NPRL provides incarcerated people with useful contacts and addresses so that incarcerated people who get the NPRL might have access to writing programs, information about college classes while incarcerated, art programs, health programs such as HIV and AIDS support. They might be able to find out about pen pals and legal aid organizations. In short, it provides many useful contacts for incarcerated people. Many organizations also stock and send in re-entry guides. And these are critical for people who are approaching the end of their mandated incarceration. These guides make these returning citizens aware of the resources they might have access to. And their lack of resources for these folks is appalling and definitely plays a role in the high recidivism rates in the United States. But it's another topic altogether. Another function of prison books programs is that they allow for people who have friends and family who are incarcerated, they allow them the ability to send in books without having to purchase them. These folks can also volunteer and gain a sense of community through working with other folks who might understand the issues that their loved ones are facing. And that's the type of support that generally is terribly lacking in our society. Another intervention these programs make is that many folks who package the books up also tend to write a brief note to the incarcerated person. And this may seem like a small thing to folks who do not have an understanding of the prison system. But for some folks who are incarcerated, this might be the only personal contact that they've had with the outside in years. So a handwritten letter from someone letting you know that you are not forgotten might mean the world. And these books themselves, they play a similar role. The books are a tangible piece of evidence that folks on the outside care enough to send you something they think you might need. And in some cases, something you specifically asked for, if we can get that exact book. Anyway, this is just the type of thing that may help someone make it through another day, right? If we can get them something that they need and let them know somebody cares. Finally, prison books programs are important for the volunteers as well. For many of us, it's a way to make a positive intervention to attempt to bring some small relief to incarcerated people. At the programs that I've been involved with, we did our best to make these programs as enjoyable as possible. I know that sounds odd in juxtaposition to the carceral state that I've been discussing. But the point is that you're doing something, that you're attempting to bring hope and light into a desperate situation. It's a way to maintain your humanity in the face of an inhumane system. All too often, activists can fall into, you know, a martyr complex. And it's the kind of beauty of the blues, you know, being able to laugh in the face of a system designed to make you cry. So, yeah, we did our best to bring a little levity. And frankly, more people volunteer and more books get inside if you can also spread a little joy in the process, right? I know it's hard. So to wrap up, this book tells the story of these various organizations, and unfortunately much of this history has been lost or is either not remembered. I hope that this book leads former volunteers to come out of the woodwork and tell their stories, and or pushes researchers to work to uncover a fuller story. There are currently dozens of these organizations operating in the United States, sending books through bars on a regular basis. There's many obstacles to sending books inside that go well beyond simple fundraising and finding a space. And, you know, I'm happy to talk about those obstacles a little later on. And in the first part of the book itself, our authors talk about some of the needs for prison books programs, clarifying that these programs are indeed necessary and serve the needs of the people that are not currently being met by the state or through private enterprise. In other parts of the book, we discuss censorship and some of the obstacles to teaching and learning inside. We talk about the history of some of these prison books organizations. And of course, as I mentioned, the interview with Lorenzo Comba Irvin clarifies that this movement was begun by incarcerated people. And we also talk about some of the efforts of the movement as a whole, how it's that the movement as a whole is made to cooperate and communicate from the prison books program to prison books program. And we have interviews with formerly incarcerated people expressing the need for and importance of books inside. We give various ways in which people can start their own prison books program, including a wonderful comic that has step-by-step instructions for those who are so inspired. And we hope that people are.
Wonderful. Thank you. That was so detailed. and for anyone, in a good way. For anyone who is listening who has not interacted with any prison books programs or heard of this, that is the tip of the iceberg. Truly, we're going to get into a lot more. One of the great things about this book is really the level of logistical detail. I think anyone would walk away feeling really empowered to start something. And I do want to say also for listeners, I don't usually say anything about myself at any point during these interviews, but I am very involved in not a prison books project, but a prison reference project. So we get hundreds of research questions a month from incarcerated people, and we have a volunteer network that answers the questions, and we get a lot of book requests that we refer out to our prison books partners. But, you know, I did not approach this book on prison books as an academic observer. This is something I'm very invested in. So I was really happy to see this on a personal level also. Before we get more into the content of the book, which we will, I want to start with a question that I always ask editors of volumes with multiple contributors. How does the book compare to what you envisioned when you first conceptualized the project? Were there any surprises?
Indeed, yeah. But first, I want to say I love that you are involved in, you know, working with incarcerated people is such an important thing to do. So thank you for that work, really, honestly. But yeah, creating an edited volume is always tricky. And in this case, you could probably, you know, compound the usual pitfalls because of the variety and experience of the authors. It was so disparate. You have people who are academics and used to writing and publishing their work. However, this is not a traditional academic book. It's more public facing. So the writing style is different even for those folks. Then you have people who are not academics, but have authored and published multiple books. And then you also have people who have not written anything like this ever in their lives. And in fact, may not have written anything for a long time. So indeed, it was an interesting group to work with and quite a pleasure, to be quite honest. And I would say that in the beginning, we were reasonably flexible with our vision. I mean, we knew we wanted to tell the story of the prison books movement, but we also knew that how that story was going to be told was in part going to be dictated by the people who volunteered to write, who volunteered to be interviewed, and who volunteered to participate, right? In other words, if we couldn't find someone to write on a particular topic, then we had to do it ourselves or find another topic that we felt was equally important that should be in the book and be covered, right? Because indeed, we couldn't do everything. We only had so much space, so choices did have to get made. For example, I think that we were hoping to get the origin stories of more programs, but, you know, as we've kind of hinted at, that can be difficult because many of the programs have lost that history even themselves, right? And keep in mind that in this case, we would be asking people who already volunteer a significant amount of their time to prison books. We'd be kind of asking them to do more work in addition to that, right? People who are already kind of overburdened by their projects and, you know, doing everything they can for the project, and that kind of ask to step aside to tell their story. And many of these people, you know, are folks that's not where their interest lies, right? They want to get the books inside and they want to work with the people inside. And so, which is completely understandable. I get it. So in terms of surprises, yeah, there were some great ones. All the interviews by formerly incarcerated people were incredibly valuable. And of course, the comic turned out beautifully. It's really hard to pinpoint all the surprises, but there were some, and they were good.
Great. And one more kind of meta question. You've touched on this. There are a lot of formats in the book. There are essays, of course. There are interviews. There's this comic. There are also photos of, like, book packing parties and flyers from fundraisers. And there are these little boxes. One is written inside, which is kind of highlighting works that were written by people while they were incarcerated. One is a one time at prison books where people just kind of share these little anecdotes. Some envelopes from that actual prison books projects received. So how did you curate all of this? Was there a particular balance you're hoping to strike?
Yeah, again, great question. And yes, there are, you know, a lot of aspects to this book. And we knew we wanted a coffee table style book, right? Like, we knew that right from the get-go. And in part because it was something that we wanted to make it something that people could pick up and put down, right? And we knew that there was such great art and so many great artists involved in the movement that it would be not difficult to make it visually appealing, right? And so, you know, we knew that this was going to be an important aspect. And there's so many great stories in this movement that these short pieces interspersed with artwork would be just a really great way to tell the story. And frankly, you know, again, artists have been incredibly important to the movement, which I think comes through, right? You know, through the flyers and through the artwork surrounding all of the Prison Books programs. In terms of curating the material, we knew the general types of material we wanted, but we didn't know exactly what we were going to get or how much of any particular type of material we were going to get, right? So we kind of had to wait and see what we received, and that helped dictate how we laid out the text and how we laid out the book. There was no way we could do everything that we wanted to with the space that we had. For example, you could write an entire book on important works that were written by incarcerated people. You know, that could be a book.
I kind of wish someone would. More, I was, I thought those were really interesting.
Well, so in my classes, I always make sure that when it comes time to talk about the Erie Canal, I always make sure that people understand that the essays that were used to create the concept and idea for the Erie Canal, where they were outlined, were written by an incarcerated person. So I try to intersperse these little tidbits into my classes whenever.
Right.
But in terms of, you know, our text, what we wanted to do was give people a taste of these different experiences and hopefully inspire them to check out their local Prison Books program, right? We wanted to kind of show them that there are these different things and, you know, it's a dynamic project, and we wanted that dynamism to kind of come through the text.
Right. So my next question is very complex, and I'm going to make it worse for you by really making it three questions.
Okay.
But I think this is all related. So much of the book is about how difficult it is to get information in any form, materials in any form, to people on the inside. And also much more of it than I expected was about the historical challenges for Prison Books projects looking to organize and exchange information with each other. For any, how do you hope Books Through Bars, this book, fits into them?
Yeah, you said that question was going to be a doozy. There's all right, let's see if we can parse it out. And by all means, if I don't cover something, please, you know, ask me to come back to it. So that's a great question. And for the first part of the question about getting information inside, it's in some ways likely more understandable for folks, as you yourself indicated, that you found it surprising that Prison Books programs were not more connected, or that there wasn't a singular national organization that we were all affiliated with. So we'll start with the first part. It needs to be understood that there is no singular prison system within the United States, right? Rather, there are multiple systems. And I'll try to do this quickly just to give an overview for your listeners. But there's a federal system.
I also, if you don't mind, if any resources come to mind, I always link things that come up in the episode notes. So if there's anything you think would be helpful for people to read or watch.
Oh, I see.
I'm making note as you mention it, and we'll make sure it's linked in the episode.
So the Prison Policy Institute really kind of outlines some really, breaks this down really well. But I'll try to give a fast summary. There's a federal system, and the federal system includes immigration detention centers and other carceral institutions, such as military prisons. Within that federal system, there are multiple levels, and each level might have its own set of rules. And in addition to the broad rules outlined by the federal system, each individual institution may create further rules, right? So you think that's complicated? Wait a second. Each state has its own prison system with its own guidelines. Okay, well, much like the federal system, each state also has varying security levels, and the rules and guidelines may differ for each level. And yes, much like the federal system, each singular institution may have additional rules and guidelines. So that's 50 states with all of those varied rules and guidelines. But we're not done yet. There's also county and local jails, and basically the story is the same for each of those institutions. So after you account for all of these official rules and guidelines at all the varying security levels and in all the varying institutions, there's also the mailroom at each institution. And basically, many of these rules and guidelines are left up to the interpretation of individual guards. Different individual guards at the same institution might have differing interpretations. So in short, there's over 6,000 institutions of incarceration in the United States. And it's in the interest of time and for the purposes of this conversation, what that really means is how do we get books into all these institutions? It's not easy is the short answer. And we can talk a little bit, we talk about this a little bit in the book. And we even highlight a successful lawsuit, well, in fact, the threat of a lawsuit to provoke an institution to change its guidelines. And after all, you know, that you can see how that connects to the how Martin Sostra sought remedy through the courts in his own way, right? And some of these institutions may request books. So, for example, right, like what are some of these rules and guidelines? Well, they really vary, and you know, I'll kind of just try to give a few, a little bit of a taste. Some of these institutions may request that books be packaged in white paper only. Other institutions mandate no hardcover books. Others only brand new books. Then there's censorship about the types of books or the types of magazines allowed or specific pictures or material in those types of magazines, right? You know, for instance, somebody got a magazine refused because it had an advertisement for adult diapers in it, right? I mean, these are things that it can get crazier than you might think or wilder than you might think. And once you learn what the guidelines are at all of the various institutions that you interact with, you're left with the reality that those rules can be changed at any given time without notice. Now, sometimes it's as easy as calling a mailroom and talking to an individual guard and clarifying what may be allowed and what may not be allowed. And sometimes that works. Other times we have to resort to lawyers or other, you know, methods through, you know, the press, what have you, just figure out other ways to seek redress. And this is where the information ecosystem of Prison Books movements becomes really important. We are connected with one another for the most part. We just don't have a singular national organization, but as we discuss in the book, we do have a communication system and we interact with one another on a somewhat regular basis, or for some folks, on a need basis, right? And this is helpful for many of us because we can share fundraising ideas, share information about the latest restrictions at any given institution. And additionally, we might share information on how we overcame those restrictions at said institutions. Or if a program receives a letter for a state that it does not serve, they might use the listserv to figure out who has the capacity to take care of those requests. Many organizations, but not all, owe their origins to anarchists and anarchist-aligned activists. Again, this is not true for all organizations in the Prison Books movement, but it is true for many. And this probably has a lot to do with why there's no singular National Prison Books parent organization, right? Many folks are kind of resistant to creating anything that's hierarchical or even potentially hierarchical. That said, as this book indicates, these organizations have successfully been around for decades and sent thousands of books inside, tens of thousands, really an untold number. I mean, it'd be so hard to estimate how many books have been sent inside by these programs nationally.
One thing I also want to highlight and add a little, this is all covered in great detail in the book, but mail is returned, that's expensive, it takes so long to get to places, and like you said, you know, there's real stakes here. This could be something, this could be a book that is directly related to someone's, you know, the material aspects of their life. You know, someone is asking for information on managing a chronic illness, or it's just this is the only person that is corresponding with this person inside, period. You know, so yeah, so the stakes are real. And one thing that we, you know, in my organization, I'm one of the volunteer trainers, and we always stress that people should err on the conservative side, not because we're endorsing these restrictions, but a lot of these facilities are massive. We are corresponding with dozens of people. And if a prison decides, if they're noticing that they're sending a lot of mail back to the prison library support network, they can just cut us off, period. And there's no appeal process, there's no anything.
Indeed, that
so there's stakes, yeah. There's stakes here.
Indeed, yeah. Returns are, you know, the bane of every Prison Books program, right? Because you send a package in and you believe that you have followed all the rules, and you send it in and it gets returned to you. Sometimes they give you information about why that package was returned, and that's helpful, right? Because now you know exactly what you're dealing with. Sometimes they don't, but you have to generally pay for that package when it gets returned to you. And then if you want to send those books back in, you have to pay again, right? So now you've paid three times to send the same package in, and all these organizations are generally strapped for cash, and it may not seem like a lot to some folks, but paying for that same package three times, now that's one incarcerated person that you're serving instead of three, right? So it's reduced your effectiveness by 66%. And those returns, again, you know, sometimes when they give you the information about why a package is returned, that may allow you to intervene. You know, and sometimes that's where the phone call to the mailroom really kind of comes into play. Sometimes one of the common ones is that they'll say you are not a authorized dealer, right? That you're not authorized to send books inside. And the simple matter of fact is that most places don't have a system whereby, you know, rules and regulations about how you become an authorized dealer. They just declare that you're authorized or not, right? There's actually currently I think Avid Books in Georgia is currently engaging in a lawsuit about this. So that's one for folks to check out and support.
Yeah, we'll make sure that is linked. Okay, you have touched on this a little. I do want to go back to that very last part of the question. You know, we have these very complex and difficult systems that we're working in. How do you see Books Through Bars fitting in, being used? What was the hope when you conceptualized this?
So the book, we're hoping that, I mean, in many ways, that's the part of introducing this movement to the general public and making people aware that this movement exists, which is so necessary, right? Like, so For example, I just got off the phone the other day with a journalist and in Asheville, North Carolina, where Asheville Prison Books is located and has been located for decades. Asheville Prison Books was the first prison books program in the Southeast, right? It's kind of pivotal to the movement in the Southeast. This journalist had no idea that Asheville Prison Books existed or what it did. Right. And so, you know, like people that even where these programs are important and, you know, an important part of the community, they're still flying under the radar with the very people who should definitively know what they are and who they are. So, you know, part of the point of this is, you know, if people gain an understanding, right, and this is where you're hoping to that this will kind of affect people, that people will see that there's an injustice occurring. And that they will be spurred to action through this injustice, right? You make them aware and make it harder to ignore this injustice, right? As I said in the beginning, these are people who are designed to be invisible and forgotten. So if we make sure that incarcerated people are not invisible and are not forgotten, then we stand a chance of moving people to action to kind of help forestall the repressive systems that keep us from getting the books inside. And I would say that, you know, most of these programs are run by people who consider themselves abolitionists, right? As you know, I am an abolitionist and I don't want to keep, my end goal isn't to keep doing prison books forever. My end goal is the end of prisons, right? But in the meantime,
brick by brick, yeah.
I'm sorry,
brick by brick.
Yeah, you know, so in the meantime, I feel like there's, you know, we have to fulfill the need and take care of the people who are incarcerated, right? And so this book, I think, you know, hopes to move people to action and, you know, create an avenue for these programs to thrive and continue to exist.
That leads in nicely to my next question. I'd like to share a quote from your interview with Lorenzo Comba Irvin, which you actually have already referenced. Another, if you're listening and you get your hands on this book and you're not reading everything, that is another great chapter. They're all great, but really,
yeah, you'll read everything.
a lot to chew on in this interview. So he says, "I still think, even to this very day, that if a radical movement is going to develop inside prisons once again, it is going to have to be a movement based around political theories, literature, and the book, in addition to a protest over oppressive conditions." End quote. So have you seen this play out, or are there any? There are definitely examples in the book of this playing out in real life. Is there anything you'd like to highlight that a contributor wrote in the book?
Yeah, I mean, that chapter by Irvin really kind of does get to that in detail. You know, and he says I've seen it, right? You know, so he says I've borne witness to what a difference this makes, you know, this access to, and in many ways, you know, I don't want people to overthink it. Like, in many ways, this is access to education, right? I mean, this is access to education and it kind of in part remedying a system of education that has failed many of these people inside, right? He talks about how, you know, teaching people to read on the inside, right? And, you know, so these are people who clearly our educational system has failed. And, you know, so now they have, you know, these books are allowing someone to kind of intervene and potentially create a more positive outcome for those folks. I mean, have I personally witnessed books making a change, you know, inside, not having been in these institutions, right? That's kind of harder for me to answer. And I think I would prefer formerly incarcerated people to kind of take that question and answer that question. But what I can answer is I can respond to how incarcerated people have let us know it matters through their letters to us, right? And so through their communications to us, we can, you know, some folks, if you've been involved in a particular program for any number of years, right? Sometimes there's, you know, people who you'll develop a correspondence with, they will, you know, request books on a regular basis. And some programs have limits on the number of times you can request over a certain period of time, right? Because they're trying to serve the greatest number of people as well, right? And so they keep records and kind of try and track to make sure that, you know, they're getting to everyone, right? But yeah, in the letters, I've definitively seen people talk about how important this access to this reading material was and what it meant to them. You know, again, people that have been purposefully forgotten by folks, you know, and just that, you know, or that they've been trying to get a hold of a particular book for, you know, months, like they've read everything but the final part of whatever series, you know, and they need that last book. I mean, and, you know, we do get a lot of requests for nonfiction books and for, you know, books where people are wanting, you know, particularly African-American history, radical African-American history flies off the shelves in prison books programs, right? People want to know about the Black Power movement. People want to, you know, see these things. They want to understand how to create a movement and how to become involved. So that is a particular aspect of the program. And I think, you know, what, you know, Irvin did discuss in his chapter as well, though, that was that, you know, part of what made that successful in his time inside was the movements on the outside as well, right? That they have to work together. And that it was the movements on the outside that kind of helped, that allowed for the movements on the inside to kind of take advantage of the opportunities that were offered to them to the fullest extent. So I think it does have to, you know, folks on the outside have to be able to support these movements.
Absolutely. I think just what this made me, what you said about how long people have been waiting for things. I don't think people on the outside who, you know, have no incarcerated loved ones, just have no real contact with the system. I don't think they always have a sense of how long people are incarcerated and how little information they have. You know, we'll respond to inquiries and somebody will say, thank you, I've been wondering about that for 20 years. And it's something that we just Googled, you know, like, there's not a great sense of the just how deprived people are. A lot of our inquiries are, what is this NFL team's score this season? What are the lyrics to this song? Like, people just have absolutely no contact with the outside world sometimes for years on end. Especially there is a chapter from an incarcerated journalist who's been in solitary at the point that she's writing for 7 years. And, you know, she gets a library card and they may or may not let her take books. Like, not just contact with the outside world, just contact with people, period. So yeah. not to go on about this. I just really wanna highlight how much it means to a lot of people to have anything.
Yeah, and people are under there's a lot of misunderstanding that, you know, prison libraries are, you know, well stocked with books. And right. I think as the chapter with Daniel McGowan kind of highlights, it really depends upon the institution that you're in. You know, you may get lucky and you may hit the jackpot and you may go into an institution that for whatever reason has a reasonable library, but that's the exception, not the rule.
Right.
Rule is that most institutions have a very poor library, and the books that they have are generally missing pages, chapters, you know, so they're not even books in their entirety, right? They're pieces of books oftentimes. So to be able to get, you know, the book that you want, and we try our best to give people the books that they want. And it's always, you know, sometimes you'll get a letter back from someone, they're like, you know, I asked for, you know, this book and you sent me this other one. And I was really bummed about that, you know, but
yeah,
I started reading it and it turned out I really liked it. So I really appreciate, you know, I mean,
that's reader's advisory.
Yeah, it happens, you know? And so, because you think about it as, you know, as a volunteer, you're like, okay, I don't have this particular book, but I think maybe, you know, you try to read into the letters, right? Like what is it this person, you know, we don't have what they want, but can I glean something from this, you know, brief letter about what it is that they might want, you know?
Yeah.
And then you try to fulfill that if you can.
I also, real quick, we're getting a little off topic, but about prison libraries, since probably a lot of librarians will be listening to this. We, the general public, I think have a very particular and rosy idea of librarians as champions of knowledge and freedom of information. And many librarians are, and that's great. But librarians are gatekeepers. This is a neutral thing that I'm saying. It's the nature of the job, right? And, you know, there are, I can't remember who wrote about this anymore. But there is somebody in this book who's writing about their own experience, and they keep getting denied books. And they finally go to the librarian and say, "Why am I not getting anything?" And she says, "Oh, it's my job to, you know, prevent you from continuing to be a heathen. I'm not giving you any of these books." You know, you might have a prison library in name, and that is not what you or I think of when we go to the library and ask for books. So something to think about as gatekeepers.
Yeah, I think that was the interview with Zoe Lawrence, I believe, right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
That sounds right.
You know, so it's, again, yeah, it's a bit, you know, like there are just entire genres of books that may not be allowed by any particular institution, because many of them have, you know, vague guidelines about, you know, anything that may ultimately disturb the peace. Well, you know, what do you mean by that? You know, like, so basically, you know, anything that may make people think, you know, that, you know, anything that the institution doesn't want them thinking or believing or acting on in any way, shape, or form, right? So that anything that loosely falls into that may be considered something that would upset the peace, right? I mean,
right.
And, you know, it's hard to get. Some institutions have banned book lists. Some states have banned book lists, and some don't. Some might and not admit it, you know, but they do have guidelines, you know. And, you know, but whether those guidelines are followed, and then the things that are on those books, those, you know, just Pulitzer Prize winning authors, you know, I mean, just books that would be in any high school literature classroom thing, they're, you know, completely disallowed for whatever reason.
Right. And Zoe Lawrence is an incarcerated trans woman, and those books were about trans topics. Anyone who's following what's going on with book bans in general, let alone in prisons, knows that those are hot topics in a bad way. So yeah, it's some of them you can predict, and sometimes it's really innocuous books. But to get kind of back to our questions, you did talk about this as part of the motivation for putting this book together. And one thing that I hadn't thought about that really struck me while I was reading is that it's really difficult to describe the history of what we'll call the modern American prison books movement. There aren't records per se. A lot of what is understood of this history comes directly from people who were involved with it. This comes through in a lot of the interviews in the book. There are a couple of places in the book where people talk in very general terms about the beginnings of the movement. And even within the book, they're not entirely consistent what people understand to be the beginnings of the movement, which is, of course, the nature of history. But I think especially when you're thinking about something like this, this very spread out, probably a lot of like anarchists who are maybe not that interested in records management and that kind of thing. So this is kind of a similar question to how you see Books Through Bars fitting into today's information ecosystems. Do you see the book fitting into the historiography of the prison books movement at all?
Well, there is no historiography of the prison books movement yet, right? So that's an easy, you know, like this, I think we hope that this book will generate that type of interest, right? I mean, there's, you know, multiple hopes with the book, and definitively the primary hope and goal is that people become inspired to action to do something with their local programs, right? But in terms of, you know, if I were to put on my historian hat for the moment, I would say that yes, indeed. What I hope is that people that were involved in, so they might pick this up, they might see this book and say, oh yeah, I did prison books back in the 70s, you know, and then they might read it and think about, oh, they don't know this story. Let me see if I can find someone to, you know, give this information to, because I remember when this program started, I was one of the founding members. We, you know, we tried to get the histories of the two oldest programs, or as we know it, the oldest programs, right? We're not, there may have been other ones that have since disappeared is the other, you know, part of it, right? Because these movements come and go just because of the nature of funding and whatnot. So some, you know, there might be a prison books program that's around for 6 months. There may be one that's around for 5 years and then goes away. You know, the longevity of these programs isn't always certain. So there's a lot we don't know, but we're hoping that this book kind of spurs that type of investigation and perhaps, you know, reminds people who were involved in the early stages of this program that they do have a story to tell. And we'd like to hear it, because I think that that would be incredibly valuable to kind of trace that history back and see kind of where those connections are between incarcerated people and the prison books programs. I mean, our guess, our thought is that it comes out of this movement, as you know, that Irvin is getting at, and that it's the support networks on the people outside supporting people in the late 60s and early 70s through the social movements that were occurring at that time, and it kind of splinters off and becomes its own thing, but we don't know for certain. So we're really hoping that this does kind of create that type of history.
Yeah, I would be so interested to see what comes out of that. We are running low on time, so I have one more question. Well, one more book question, and then one more closing question for you. This is something that is discussed in detail in the book. There is a pervasive movement in prison administration to move as much paper as possible to electronic form, up to and including, this is something that, you know, as an organization that deals with prison letters, we follow very closely. And since we started doing nationwide service in 2020, several states, now there are no letters go directly to facilities. An entire state's mail is sent to a scanning facility somewhere in Florida, and that facility scans the mail, and people inside get scans or printouts of scans. Which, of course, when we're dealing with books, is a whole other issue. Read the book. There's a lot about tablets. We don't have to get into it right now, because it's all in the book. So just more generally, more philosophically, what do people lose when they can't access physical books and libraries?
Well, I think there's something tactile about a book, right? I mean, from the smell to the feel of the pages on your hands. I mean, it's to the other people that have held it before you. I mean, that book has a history, right? That book is an entity in and of itself. And I think that, you know, being able to have physical copies of the books is so different in so many ways, and you don't need a screen. It's much more of a personal interaction. And I think that you also, the tablets, there's lots of, and I don't want to go too far down this road, but there's lots of other dangers with the tablets. There's the control of the tablets. There's the monitoring of the tablets. What are you reading? How often are you reading it? So there's information being collected and you're being monitored while you're on those tablets. It's not as if you get the book is yours, and you can, you know, so long as you're allowed to keep that book, you are, you know, you can look at that book as many times as you want, read whatever pages, and it's yours to do that whenever you want. With the tablet, that's not the case. And your access to these things may be pulled at any given point in time, right? And it's would make it more difficult, right? These books, some of the people who formerly incarcerated people talk about, or I'm talking a little faster as I know we're running out of time. Some of the formerly incarcerated people, talk about the importance of sharing books inside, right? And so the ability to share your tablet, that's probably not, I would imagine, not going to happen, right? And so that kind of takes away that sense of community, right? To where you're like, that was a big thing. It's a big thing for people to be able to share those books. It makes you feel good to be able to share that book with someone. And then also, you know that you're performing a service for your larger community. So I think that it really, the tablets are going to cause and are causing a lot of harm in a myriad of ways. And the last thing, I would say on that is that's an evolving situation, and definitively, pay attention to what's in the book, quite certainly, but also, there's this, as I said, it's an evolving situation. So you'll see articles coming out about censorship through tablets and the use of tablets in prisons. But finally, the last big thing about that is that it takes away the handwritten letter. And that, I think, is a crime. To be able to, if you are getting a letter from your loved one, to know that your loved one touched that, and you can kind of feel even on the paper where the pen touched the paper, and just, you know, that they held that in their hands, and you can see the arc of their handwriting unfiltered through digital, manipulation, what have you. It's just so much different. It hits you viscerally in a way that the image of it doesn't on a tablet. And it takes away that human to human interaction that I think is already taken away so much. It's just one more step, losing one of the very few human to human interactions with outside people that people have on the inside. And it's a crime.
I could not agree more. And on that fairly dire note, I'll ask you one last question.
All right,
question.
Wait, hold on. So I would like to say, that we can't leave on a dire note. So I would like to say, prison books, volunteering for prison books can be such a great experience. And there's something for everyone, right? You don't have to be someone who likes to write letters. You can be someone who loves books. You can be someone who goes to one of the programs that has a large library, and you're just organizing the library continually because volunteers are, misplacing things and what have you. And you're just making sure it's easier for everyone to find what they need. There's always new books coming in to stack and stock. You can be somebody who's just, what you like to do is just package and address things, we got you covered. If you're a good fundraiser, we got you covered. There's a place for everybody. So come on down. We'll have a good time.
Great. So on that less dire, on that hopeful note, the classic New Books Network closing question. What are you working on now?
Currently, I am working on a graphic history of the Brotherhood of Timber Workers that'll be published with the Historic New Orleans Collection, and it should be out next spring.
Great. Well, we'll keep an eye on that. I hope you pitch it as a New Books Network book so somebody in that area can pick it up and we can also listen. And thank you so much for taking the time. This has been great.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.